If you enjoy Astronomy FM Radio, please let us know with a small donation. We do rely on your support, and it's true. Every little bit counts.
AFM. You're listening to AFM Radio on astronomy.fm, around the world and beyond.
Arr. Coming up next, it's time for an AFM Radio original program, Space Pirate Radio, brought to you by the Voice of Astronomy MIDI. This is astronomy.fm.
The pirates are coming. The pirates are coming. The pirates are coming. You better watch.
Arr. It's Space Pirate Radio time, fuckos, here on Astronomy.fm Radio. So that means it is another Wednesday evening, and this one just happens to be July the 12th, 2017, for those of us in the eastern portion of North America. Universal time, it would put it at July the 13th, Thursday morning, 2017, at 1 o'clock in the morning. So that means right now we are live, but, some of you will be listening to us in the repeat, as we repeat the program every 4 hours for the next 24 hours. And of course, I want to welcome the crew aboard. That is those people that happen to come into our chat room. And we invite you all to come into our chat room before we sail through the universe, checking out everything going on there. Pyramids, UFOs. Oh, well, anyways, we got you and me in there. We've got Twist Edge, Aquafew, Glenn, Optronics, Black Project, Evil Spock, Plaid Mac, Plaid Sister. Had somebody pop in earlier. Maybe you'll be back again. Noxious. Maybe you'll be back to listen in. New person. Welcome if you're listening in. And welcome, of course, if you're in the chat room. So come on over to the chat room at astronomy.fm/chat and log in with us. If you want to ask us a question, feel free to do so. And we'll try to answer it on the air. We'll certainly say hi to you. And don't forget, we'll put links to the articles that we talk about in our chat room and also on our Space Pirate Radio Facebook page, too. So don't forget to go and like that page so you can find out what's going on. We always announce, especially if we're having a live show or if there's a reason we have to cancel live and go with a classic show, too. So you can get an idea of what's going on before the show. All right, let's see what we got. I'm proud to say we can start out with the sun tonight.
Yeah, because something is actually happening.
There is a huge, yes, I'm going to say huge, sunspot on the sun right now. It's almost on the solar meridian, just slightly past. Easily should be naked eye, which means if you hold a solar filter up to your eye without the telescope, just hold the filter up to your eye, look at the sun. If your eyes are good enough, you should be able to spot the spot on the sun. Part of a group, which is actually part of Jupiter, but I'd say this sunspot's about 3-4 times the size of the Earth, approximately. Kind of a rare one. It's been flaring for the past week and a half or so as it's been on this side of the sun. We've still got another week or so for it to be on this side of the sun. So if it happens to flare up right now, that means the stuff is pointing right towards us, and those energized particles will stream across the solar system, get pulled down by our magnetic fields, and if they're energetic enough, maybe those of us in the northern hemisphere might be able to catch some aurora. Certainly everybody in the southern hemisphere will be able to catch some aurora since they have the most nighttime, and we have the least amount of nighttime right now. So check out the sun. It's actually doing pretty good for a change. How nice. Checking out solar winds. Solar winds are just okay, so we're not really picking up high winds right now at only 400 kilometers per second, and density is pretty low at 1.8 protons per cubic centimeter. So that indicates that the solar winds are not really hitting us right now. But if it flares up, you know, when it's facing towards us, then we got a good chance of catching some particles from the sun and lighting up the skies for a change. Oh, and you were saying that I figured out how to do this. When I was linking to the sun in our Facebook page, it was just going to the main page. What I got to do is I have to click on, and I'll do that right now. I clicked on the picture once or twice, actually, enlarged it a little bit. Let me put it into our chat room now.
Static image as opposed to the live one that refreshes and breaks.
That's correct. So here's that image. That should be able to pop that into the chat room and on Facebook page, and it will hold. So you actually get to see what the sun that we're actually talking about right now. So later on, as the repeat programs go on, you might want to go to the Space Pirate Facebook page, and then as you listen to us, you can click on the links that will be there, and you'll be able to see the things that we're actually talking about. A little easier to follow along that way instead of just listening. It's up to you. So, Good Sunspot should be Naked Eye. If we get some sun, there were a lot of people complaining about fog and rain and stuff like that. I've got my solar binoculars ready to pull out. I've already pulled them out, so I need to get some clear skies, maybe another couple days, and I'll be able to look at it with my solar binoculars. And if I get ambitious this weekend, maybe I'll pull my scope out and head up to the club's observatory and do a little solar observing.
Nice.
I think we need to look at that idea about getting a hydrogen alpha telescope.
Oh, yes. The observatory chair would be happy to spend some money on that.
Oh, yes, but with the board.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, a reasonable hydrogen alpha scope. We're not spending $10,000 on one.
No, I'm thinking 3 to 4, maybe. Yeah.
Put together a proposal.
Okay. Because I think, do we have a filter for the 8-inch?
I'm not the person you should be talking to about the gear. Plus, most of our audience can't go there.
I know. It's okay. But it's just the way people work with observatories and stuff like that. So we have the club has an 8-inch refractor.
Yes.
So I'm thinking if we can get a white light solar filter for the main scope and get a smaller, much smaller hydrogen alpha telescope bolt on top of it, that they would pair really well to each other.
Yeah, definitely to run that by our observatory chair and see what we can set up.
All right. Of course, you know, once we do that, there won't be any more sunspots.
Well, yeah. We'll do that, and there won't be any sunspots for 4 years straight.
Exactly. But we'll work on that then. All right, let me give you a little rundown on what's up in the sky as far as the moon and planets go and stuff like that. Oh, I hope I remember where all this stuff was.
Jupiter's slipping away.
Jupiter's definitely slipping away. So I guess the best way of looking at Jupiter would be go to the Juno images. And Juno is actually circling around Jupiter right now and just got some images of the Great Red Spot. I don't have any links for that right now, but we'll get some in there pretty soon. So check out the NASA website and check out the Juno mission, because Juno just imaged the Great Red Spot. And, of course, Jupiter's out there in the early part of the evening, but you better get your views in sooner than later, because it's slowly drifting towards the setting sun, and we won't have that much opportunity to observe it for that much longer. But keep observing it. As I always say, as it gets close to the sun, sometimes this is when something happens, right before it's getting ready to disappear. So that's the best time to look at Jupiter, and you might catch an impact. They always seem to happen before it disappears or right after it reappears from behind the sun. Keep checking it out. Still out there, still visible, and still near the star Spica. And Saturn's out there too, so you'll actually notice them getting closer and closer, and we'll keep you up to date on us. Oh, good. My clock dung. Jupiter is approaching Saturn. A couple years, 2019, I think, will be a super conjunction. I'm sorry, it's going to be called an astronomy.fm super conjunction. I'm spreading this rumor that it's going to look like they're going to collide in space. So that should be properly misinterpreted, that they are going to collide, and we'll start another semi-true astronomy rumor out there.
One of these days you are going to regret this, Marty.
Or make a lot of money from it.
No, I'm going with option A here.
All right, tomorrow, July the 13th at 18 hours, Neptune will be 0.9 degrees north of the moon. There will be an occultation, and I checked this one out. It is going to be in Australia. So another, where are we at, about 2 hours, another 16 hours from now, something like that. Australia, check out the moon, and you'll see it actually go in front of Neptune. Friday, we got Venus 3 degrees north of Aldebaran. Have you seen Venus lately?
No, I haven't seen it since end of May.
Oh, you've got to see it in the morning sky. It is spectacularly bright.
Spectacular at daybreak in May, but no, I've not had a good early morning. Of course, early mornings are quite early for us right now, and we're out in Michigan.
Yeah, that's true. I was watching it a week ago, something like that, and I could see Pleiades rising, and then Venus is rising, and it looks like airplane headlights that are landing, the landing lights. It's that bright. It's got to be -4 right now, about at its brightest. It was like too bright to have been Venus, but it was Venus. Because I watch it for a while and watch it get higher and higher. And it happens to be at the other tip of the horn of Taurus the Bull. Because, what is it, Aldebaran? Yes, Aldebaran's the other tip of the horn, right?
Aldebaran's the eye of the bull.
El Nath
is one of the horns.
Well, Venus, that's the other tip of the horn, El Nath.
Okay. Is it the one that it shares with Capella? I haven't seen it myself yet lately. Is it the one that it shares with Auriga, or is it the one that's off on its own?
I can't.
Be cool. That would be really cool.
Let's see. Is it shares it with... no, it's not the one that shares it with Capella.
Okay, so it's outshining El Nath. That's
yes.
Cool.
So, let's see. It's Ain. It's right next to Ain. What's El Nath? No, it's Aldebaran.
Aldebaran's the eye.
Aldebaran's the eye, but it's also at the tip of the short horns.
Yeah, okay.
You get the long
horns. Oh, the tip of the Hyades. Okay.
Yeah, the tip of the Hyades horns.
Yeah.
Yes.
It's right.
Okay, so Aldebaran's one tip, and Venus is the other tip.
That would be striking, yes. That sounds worth getting up quite early for.
Yeah, but you'll find, though, that Venus is so bright, it actually way outshines Aldebaran. Aldebaran looks kind of dim compared to that.
Well, Aldebaran, I mean, it's quite a bright star, but it's not even one of the brighter stars in that great hexagon that we see in the northern hemisphere through the winter. So it's, Venus would definitely put it to shame.
So definitely get a look at it and see how much of the Hyades you can actually see amongst the glare of Venus there. It is pretty spectacular to see right now. Check that out. All right, then we got Sunday. The moon's at last quarter. Next Monday, Uranus 4 degrees north of the moon. I'm going to go a little bit farther because there's a couple of occultations coming up. On Thursday, July the 20th, Aldebaran will be 0.4 degrees south of the moon, and there will be an occultation. I checked this one out, and this one is visible from around Saudi Arabia through India. So if you live in that area, you can actually watch the moon go in front of Aldebaran on Thursday, July the 20th.
Cool.
And we'll come up with some more stuff, too. Oh, on that same day, and, oh, wait, I was just talking about that, wasn't it? Yeah, Aldebaran, right in Taurus, the bull I was just talking about. Of course, Venus will be just north of the moon that same time. Now, that's going to be an interesting sight to see on the 20th. Watching the moon cover Aldebaran while Venus is in the Hyades also.
That would be amazing. That would be calendar. Take a picture of that, and that's going in the club calendar.
Mm-hmm. If I say the occultation, well, they'll be close, but the occultation will actually be visible around India and Saudi Arabia area. But it's still the moon, and it's going to be close to Aldebaran for us here. I didn't look to see if it was going to be north of according to this, it's going to be north of Aldebaran a little bit. It'll still be pretty cool to see, though, all those things together. So check that out. Oh, by the way, I get all these information I get from the Astronomical Almanac Online, which is at asa.usno.navy.mil. I'll pop that into our chat. Even though it'll basically just takes you to the homepage of this, and it's right on the front page. So they change it every week. So you can basically, like I do, go there every week and check it and see what's happening with the moon and the planets together in the sky. Of course, Saturn's out there with its wing Yeah, wings. Rings wide open.
Saturn is phenomenal.
Yep.
Jaw-dropping. Beautiful. This is one of these things. And I've, over the years, you know, when people say, oh, man, Saturn is the best thing. And I'm like, yeah, you know, Jupiter. Jupiter is awesome. But Saturn as it is right now, yes, mind-blowing, gorgeous, looks like painted on your eyepiece, phenomenal.
Mm-hmm.
Can't say enough good things about Saturn right now.
So you got like an evening full of planets and a morning full of planets.
Yeah, though, actually, position-wise, Black Projects makes a great point in the chat room. Saturn's boring, is too low for me. Saturn is low, so it's hanging out along the ecliptic in the south.
Mm-hmm.
And since that is a low ecliptic indeed during the summer months, Saturn is down in the muck a lot of the time.
Yeah.
At higher latitudes.
Yep. I think it was Black Projects I was talking with earlier. So yeah, it's really, really low and hard to get good images of it, especially for us here just north of a major city called Detroit.
Yeah.
That which really hazes up the skies down there. So yeah. Really hard to get good images. The rings are wide open, but so low for us in the northern hemisphere, it's hard to get good images. Southern hemisphere observers have pretty much got it
primed. Lucky you. It is beautiful.
Mm-hmm. Way up there. So you'll get the best images probably from the southern hemisphere of Saturn.
Totally. It would be riding high, you know, hanging out between mm-hmm. Sagittarius and Scorpius and just... mind-blowing.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah, actually, we have somebody who can tell us. Hey, Optronics, let us know. What is it like for you down there in the southern hemisphere?
Saturn must look pretty good.
Yeah, it must.
It's like kind of the quick glances that we get in between the turbulence, you know, when it just clicks real clear for a fraction of a second.
Yeah, because you can see the Cassini division, so the major gap between the ring in the ring system is just breathtaking.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, with a good still night and a high-powered scope, you could see all kinds of details in the ring, like the Encke Minima and moons, lots of moons. Of course, mm-hmm. the moons are actually shown off to the best advantage when Saturn is aligned with us, so you really don't see any rings.
Mm-hmm.
But nonetheless, Saturn has enough good moons that they're putting on a good showing, even with the rings at the angle they are.
Yep.
Oh, Optronics points out, he lives in a really large city of 4 million people, so his skies are not that good.
Yeah, got to get out away from the city.
Yeah, I had a friend who did, she did a college, stint in college down in Buenos Aires, and she said, she reported regretfully to me that she could see no stars from where her apartment was. None.
Mm-hmm.
So, it's that way in, you know, quite a few U.S. cities also.
Yeah, under the light dome.
Under the light dome, nothing to see.
Yep. I was also thinking Pluto's out. Pluto's out there too.
Pluto is out there.
Yeah, it's in Sagittarius, off the handle of the teapot.
Yep, it's going to be in Sagittarius for a while.
Yep. So if you haven't seen Pluto, if you get hold of a really nice big telescope, this is the time to start looking for it. For Northern Hemisphere observers, I should say, because it doesn't stick above the horizon for very long.
No.
We've got that tiny little arc right due south of those constellations of Scorpius and Sagittarius, and they don't stay up very high throughout the night, and they don't stay in our sky very long because we have such little nighttime. So you got a very narrow window to catch something like that.
Aqua for You points out, he says 75% of Americans can't see the Milky Way.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, I had a very good night, our last open house. We had several visitors who it was their first time at our observatory, and it was a moonless night. The way that the calendar fell, we had no moon for that part of the observing night, and they hadn't seen the Milky Way before. So even though in between our suburban light glow and the fact that it was, the conditions were a little iffy.
Mm-hmm.
I was able to point out to them the chunk of the Milky Way that goes from Cassiopeia through the Great Triangle, and they were happy campers because they had never seen that before.
Mm-hmm.
That was cool.
Yep. One little last thing, the asteroid Vesta is kind of north of Regulus, so again, it's like...
Regulus is gone, baby, it's, gone. As far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, I guess it's kind of, you have to have a really good western horizon.
Yeah, good, clear western horizon.
Yeah, but there was another asteroid that was, we just passed opposition of, was it Juno?
Might I believe be. It was Juno you were talking about earlier.
Yeah. I think it was Juno, probably somewhere.
It was
somewhere,
definitely not Vesta.
Yep. I think it's somewhere around Capricorn, if I'm not mistaken. All right. So, got some major asteroids out there to go look for. So, don't forget to do that.
Glenn has a question.
All right, let's go for it.
He would like to know what magnitude, or I suppose he means magnification, does it take to see the Cassini division from land-based observing?
Well, I know that just to see the rings themselves, you need to start with 20 power. So I'm going to say somewhere around, just by my remembering, maybe about 150 power. A couple things are with observing detail like that is with sky conditions sometimes moderate, you end up seeing a little bit more detail with a little bit lower power. So if you have a really excellent steady night, then you definitely could use a lot more power to pick it up and still be nice and clear. But if it's just a moderate night, you crank up the power, you find that the image deteriorates pretty badly, rather quickly, and you can end up actually using less magnification and seeing more detail, even though it's starting to make the image a little smaller. So there's kind of a balance between big enough to make it visible and small enough so that you can still pick out the detail when the sky conditions are moderate. So I'm thinking about 150 power. Aqua's guessing at 50 power. I think that's going to be a little low for Cassini division. Need a little extra power on that. But that's just from my recollection. Something to try if we get clear skies this weekend or something. So you need a little bit of power to see Cassini's division, but mostly you need good optics and steady skies.
Or terrible optics and a really big telescope.
That could do
it. Keep in mind what Cassini was using, you know. That was back in the day when, and to try to get away from chromatic aberration, which is where you see false color in the eyepiece, they built these insanely long telescopes.
Yeah, that's how they used to measure the telescopes, by the focal length of the lens. They're, all the lenses are about the same size. They're 3 or 4 inches. But the length of the scope was getting, you know, starting at 10 feet, going to 20, 40, 80, 120, 150 feet long for like a 3-inch lens. It's really hard to point, but they were doing it, yeah, just to get rid of the color refracting off the main lens, which is acting as much as a lens as it was a prism. I just looking at my picture that I took a few weeks ago of Saturn. Had it really enlarged, it's really big, but I don't see Cassini's division in it at all. It's too fuzzed out. And I don't think I could process it to make it better anyways. Yeah, it's a little tougher now again because, again, it's low for us Northern Hemisphere observers. But the rings are wide open, so balancing. Everything's a big balance. We'll try it, but I'm sure like 150 power you should start to see Cassini's division in it. All right, let's see what we've got going on here. Oh, I wonder if it's going to pop up a picture. You know, I didn't even look at images of Jupiter.
Oh, the JunoPix? No, I've been behind. But I've been traveling. I was actually down in Pensacola, Florida, visiting our very own PLADMAC.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Was it really hot there?
It was pretty hot. It could have easily been worse. It was much worse when we went down to Orlando and the Space Coast in July of 2011 to see Atlantis take off for the final time. That was intolerable.
Mm-hmm.
There'd been some rain through there, and it was hotter than I like and more humid than I would like, but it wasn't that bad for Florida in the summertime.
Mm-hmm. I'm trying to go through the Juno images and see the great red spot picks. And
yeah.
Not quite getting it. Well, they've got these kind of like hourglass ones. Let's see if I can click on this one. And let's see. It's in the image processing section. Oh, something I've never hit before. Well, anyways, the red spot, according to this picture, not very impressive. It's kind of mushy. All this super detail we've been seeing lately in Jupiter's clouds and the great red spot looks like it's kind of smoothed out. There's not a whole lot of detail in this picture. I don't know.
Well, it looks like a big old pepperoni.
Yeah.
Which it kind of always did, at least in my lifetime.
Pepperoni through a foggy oven window.
Yeah, no, I see what you mean. There's some, definitely it's not the crispness of the cloud swirls that we've been seeing. Well, yeah, take Cassini pictures, for example.
Mm-hmm.
So, right, it looks a bit blurred. It looks like somebody took some paint on a palette and mushed it around. So
something they are saying, though, this image is a basically a raw image. So it's the raw data. So, and there's actually a project here about having the public process it.
Cool. That's one way of doing it.
Let me put this link up here, and that's kind of what I was looking in. And I'll put this into our chat room. And so if you like doing image processing, here's something you can, NASA's letting you do ahead of time. Process this image of the great red spot and see if you can make it a lot better.
So this, you're right. So this, presumably after processing, this picture will look a lot more sharp. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You got one from university there. It's definitely better than the raw one that I got from NASA.
Hey, Aqua for You has a question about what the best color filters are to use with Saturn and Jupiter. And of course, there's a fairly wide range of opinion on that. My personal feeling is I like a yellow gel filter on Saturn, and I like a pale blue filter on Jupiter.
Yep.
Not the dark blue, but the light blue filter that you tend to get in a 5-pack or a 6-pack.
Yep, I like that too. The Jupiter one is because it will actually increase the contrast, so those dark bands will actually, because they're kind of yellowish, the blue one will make them a little bit darker.
Browner, yeah.
Yep, increase the contrast. The yellow one for Saturn is because everybody likes Saturn looking yellow.
Well, there's another way you can do that. That's why I like viewing Saturn in twilight when the contrast is a little lower and the color is richer.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think Saturn is prettiest shortly after sundown, if you can capture it then.
Yep.
And again, but if you can't, a yellow filter does do the trick.
Yep. Well, as far as making it look nice and yellow, I don't think it actually brings out much more detail in it, though. I don't think it increases the contrast in the rings or anything, does it?
Not that I appreciably remember, but it's actually been quite some time since I used filters on planets. That was more of a thing in the when I was first getting into astronomy. We got our 6-pack of filters, and we got our O2 and all of our nice filters and trying them out. So, and frankly, the experience of having a red filter on Mars.
Yes.
At a very high-profile observing session that my husband did last year, you know, that soured me just a little bit. And it is, well, we really should be seeing it as there. But Jupiter with a light blue filter is lovely.
Yes.
Even if you don't want to heighten the red on Mars, because that does take out some of the detail, or heighten the yellow on Saturn, Jupiter with the pale blue is cool.
Actually, the red filter on Mars not only increases the redness of the red areas, but it actually darkens the green areas. So it does increase the contrast of the darker areas on Mars. That's what I use it to actually see more detail on Mars.
That is not how it went for my husband when he was at Yerkes, but... You know, that's a pretty exceptional telescope and a pretty exceptional observing experience without filters.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, part of it, though, is it can increase the contrast, but it can also make the colors look funny. I mean, if you're looking for that illusory green that tricked people into thinking that Syrtis Major was vegetation or what, it's going to wash it out. It's going to turn it brown.
Yeah. Depends. You got to use filters with the thought that you're basically trying to improve your view. Well, sometimes.
Sometimes.
You know, if you think about, okay, I want to improve the view of Mars by using a red filter to darken the dark spots and keeping the red spots, I mean the red areas redder. To actually improve the view of Jupiter with a light blue filter, which actually darkens the band, that makes it better. Like a yellow filter on Saturn just makes it look more pleasing to look at. And same thing with the sun. If your solar filter makes the sun kind of bluish, and then sometimes you can pop in a yellow filter just to make it look more like the sun. The sun look more yellow when you're using your filter. So that doesn't increase the contrast when you put a yellow filter on a bluish sun, but it does make it look more pleasing to look at.
Mm.
Yeah, try different stuff too. Try all of your filters. I've done this before too. I have tried different nebula filters on everything. You know, try them on the planets. Try to get a nebula filter, pop it in, or at least hold it in front of the eyepiece and look at the planet and see if you see any more detail that way. You can try polarizing filters, color filters, even ones that should not work at all.
Yeah, that is part of the fun. That's something I definitely remember when I started out. It's like, yeah, let's just throw anything in there. Oh, hey, this is not the recommended filter to use on this object, but hey, it worked.
It worked, so yes.
Yeah.
Same thing with the moon, too.
Yes.
Try different filters on the moon. And now that's going to be for being able to see a little bit more detail. It's going to change the color, and the color can be kind of funny. But just try it and see if you actually notice more detail. It could help the way your eye works on stuff like that. So just try them and look for more and more detail. So you have to kind of really train your eye to do that, though. The first time people see the moon, like you said, somebody says a green filter on the moon, they go, the moon's green, ew, green cheese, ha, ha, ha. Like, not realizing that you might actually see more detail that way.
Oh, yeah, because the moon can be so incredibly bright that putting the green on there, it allows you to see the detail, but your eyes aren't getting literally tired from looking at this thing.
That's right. When I look at the moon through a telescope, I usually wear sunglasses.
Not a bad idea.
I do. It actually really helps. Just use sunglasses when you're looking at the moon. You don't get that, night blindness.
We do have another question from the chat room, but we have hit the bottom of the hour, so I think it's time for a station ID break.
I think you are correct about that. You are listening to Space Pirate Radio here on astronomy.fm. It is 9:32 on... July the 12th. What Pecan Pie Day?
Universal time. Yeah. Okay.
We talked about this earlier.
Pecan, you say pecan. Yeah.
You don't like.
Yogurt. I don't like them.
You don't like pecans.
Yeah, so it's more for you.
I like pecans. Glenn likes pecans. I think Glenn lives in the pecan capital of the South, actually.
Oh, really? Wow.
Something like that, if I recall. So anyways, it is July the 12th, 2017, 9:33 for those of us that live in the eastern portion of North America. So that would make it universal time, 1:33, July the 13th, Thursday morning, 2017. So halfway through our program, we still have another half hour to go. So, obviously stick around. If you just tuned in, don't worry. We're going to repeat this program every 4 hours for the next 24 hours. And of course, after Space Pirate Radio, we always have more programming like Astronomy Ireland, sometimes Comet Watch, and sometimes Planetary Radio, Planetary Scientist, Naked Astronomy, Naked Scientist, all coming up after Space Pirate Radio. So stick around or catch us in the repeat.
Or catch us on the rebound.
Yep. And of course, don't forget, we will have, well, that would be like a dating thing, wouldn't it?
For basketball.
There you go. Yeah, I guess so. What was I going to say? Oh, our Facebook page. Don't forget Space Pirate Facebook page. You can look at the links, and you can even, if you're listening on the repeat, you can even click on each of the links and look at the same thing that we're actually talking about, or do some more reading a little bit later if you want to get into a little bit more detail about the articles we're talking about. And, of course, we will take suggestions in our chat room, too, from topics. If you have any questions, please feel free to ask them in our live chat room. It's the best way. And we'll go over that. Let's say hi to everybody in our chat room right now. Let's see. We have, of course, you and me. We've got Twist Edge, Aquafew, Glenn, Optronics, Black Projects, Plaid Mac, Plaid Sister, Plaid Joan, Richie, Noxus, and Evil Spock in our chat room. And we consider you part of our Space Pirate crew. I'm glad to have you all here with us. All right, Optronics has a question. What is the Coriolis effect? You want to do that one?
No, I don't. Because you handle it.
All right.
I learned it wrong. I was taught wrong.
About which way things curve?
No, about the whole toilet bowl thing, which is totally rubbish. Oh, you can see the Coriolis effect by flushing the toilet, and it'll go one way in the northern hemisphere and one way in the southern. Yeah, no.
Yeah, the Coriolis effect. Okay, we'll do the little bit of the faux science and then the real science of it.
Yeah. So myth. You can tell the toilet will flush in a different direction depending on which side of the equator you are on.
Yes. It's noticed that first off, with, for instance, if you have a pendulum, a really long pendulum, and if you, there's ways that you can actually get them to keep on going, and if you start them out like due north and south, because of the Earth's rotation, the pendulum will actually change its angle as the Earth turns around once in 24 hours. That basically the angle of the pendulum will also do the same thing. Now, some people have noticed that water going down a drain will actually spiral in a direction, whether it's clockwise or counterclockwise. And people thought, oh, that's the Coriolis effect. That's the direction it turns is because of the Earth's rotation. Turns out that part's not true, because it's more dependent on the shape of the drain in your sink will affect the way the water goes down into a drain, whether it goes clockwise or counterclockwise. Yeah. I remember somebody, they were on the equator, and someplace, it might be Africa or South America or something like that. There's a video of it, world traveler on the equator, and this guy's got two sinks right on the equator, one on the north side of the equator, one on the south side of the equator, pours water down both of them, and the water spirals down the drain in different directions. Now, if you notice any science and you know about the Coriolis effect, the drains are flowing backwards to what should have been the Coriolis effect.
Ah.
Yeah.
That's pretty good.
Mm-hmm. Now, you want to explain the more sciencey part with weather?
Yeah. So, okay. So, now that we've established what the Coriolis effect is not.
Mm-hmm.
Which nothing to do with your toilet or my toilet or anywhere.
Or your sink or anything like that, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, so there's a pattern of, okay, storms swirl, it's weather patterns. Storms swirl clockwise in the southern hemisphere. They really do. It's not a myth, like toilets. And in the northern hemisphere, they go counterclockwise. So it's a really simple thing to see. There's some nice graphs that where you can see it visualized, but it really is a dividing line on either side of the equator. And it increases with increased latitude. So it's more pronounced depending on where your latitude is. What causes it? Rotation of the Earth on a free-moving object, which is what storms are, basically. They're hanging out in the atmosphere, moving. So objects of the northern hemisphere get deflected to the right, and in the south, they get deflected to the left.
At the equator.
Oh, now you're getting tricky.
Yes, because, the equator spins faster than the poles.
Yes, it does.
So if you think about, a disk north of the equator, the edge of the disk closest to the equator will spin the direction that the Earth rotates at, because the Earth rotates faster at the equator than it does in the pole. So anything closer to the pole will spin in the opposite direction because of the equator pulling it in one direction. So it's usually like storm systems that you'll notice that the edge that's closest to the equator will spin in the same direction as the equator, and then the region that's closest to the pole, because of that rotation, will spin in the opposite direction. We're kind of used to that when we have, especially winter storms, they make a big circle around our state here in Michigan.
Yeah, oh yes,
they 45 degree latitude. Yeah, we have a counterclockwise rotation. So even if a storm is coming out of the east, a lot of times during that time, we will have winds coming out of the west, because we're getting the backward spin. Or it actually changes direction. First, we get hit with the front edge of the storm. It's spinning from the west to the east. And then as it's, you know, we catch the other end of the storm, it's now spinning from the east to the west, backwards. Southern hemisphere would be the opposite.
Yeah, so if the Earth didn't spin, aside from the fact that life on Earth would be irrevocably different from what we know, you wouldn't see that. You would just see the Earth, the air currents circulating from the high pressure zones to the low pressure zones in mm-hmm. just a straight pattern. So high pressure at the poles, low pressure at the equator, and it would just go back and forth.
Yep. Here's one. I think Glenn knows the answer to this one. What planet in our solar system spins opposite to the planet's rotation? Well, actually, what planet in our solar system rotation is spinning? So it would be what planet in our solar system rotates opposite to its orbit of the other planets. And that, I do believe, is Venus.
Yes.
Yep, evil Spock got it. It is Venus,
yep.
Yes.
It is Venus. Well, and Uranus.
Uranus
is weirder, much weirder.
It's tipped over sideways, so kind of hard to figure out.
It's a little meaningless at that point.
Yeah.
But yeah, Venus definitely does mm-hmm. opposite rotation.
It would be a lot easier if we could actually see surface detail on Venus and actually watch it.
Yeah, but we can't because of the clouds.
Exactly. Yeah, so it'd be a little easier to understand that.
When the clouds rotate at a different speed from the planet.
Another thing that came up too was, just like at our last meeting, the sun, how much faster. The sun actually rotates faster along the equator than it does at the poles. I can't remember, it was like 34 days or something like that at the equator and 28, 29 days or 27 days, something like that at the poles. So I have to look it up again.
Well, you would be able to see that measuring how long it takes a sunspot to cross.
That's right. A little faster at the equator.
Yep.
But covers more distance too.
Yes.
Let's see, again, our article about, Sophia. Let me pop this into our chat room here.
Cool. My favorite modified 747 that's still flying around.
Mm-hmm.
Now that the shuttle carrier is parked at a museum down in Houston, Texas.
Yes. Of a, I lost it. Where does that article go? There it is. Okay. Sophia is going to study a distant Kuiper Belt object because there's going to be, I think it's the next target that the New Horizons spacecraft is actually going to fly by.
Yep.
Designated 2014 MU69. Now that object is actually going to pass in front of a star, so that will allow us to, if you're in the shadow of the object compared to the star, a couple things you can actually see. You can actually see if there's anything orbiting around it, if it happens to be in the right spot. Because what happens, well, obviously when an object goes in front of a star, it blinks out the starlight. Now, if it blinks out the starlight before the object goes in front of it, that tells you there's something there. If it blinks out after the object goes in front of the star, that tells you there's something on the other side of it. If it blinks out in front of the object and behind the object, that tells you you're probably looking at rings. Otherwise, you might be looking at moons. Also, if the object, when it goes in front of the star, if you're actually measuring the spectrum of the star, and all of a sudden a few new elements get added to the starlight just before the object goes in front of the star, that shows you that that object has an atmosphere. And you can figure out what kind of elements are in the atmosphere of that object, in this case, that Kuiper Belt object. So if it has an atmosphere, the atmosphere will go in front of the star first. It'll actually show up as a different, slightly different spectrums, and they can tell what chemicals are in the atmosphere of that object. And they get two shots at it, too. So the atmosphere will go in front of the star first, then the object will come out, and then the atmosphere will come out from the star, too. So you can actually do quite a bit of research by having a star, an object go in front of a star like that. Won't be able to see that from anywhere here on the Earth for the general public because it's going to happen over one of the oceans.
Yeah.
That's why they're going to have to use Sophia to observe it. So they'll fly along the path. That means that they'll be able to get the as long as observations as possible of the object, and it'll stretch out the time. So instead of we can also tell, by the way, how big the object is, too. So if you know how far away it is, you can tell how big it is by how long it takes the starlight to blink out. Just do a little bit of math that way. Now, if you fly along the path of the shadow, that means it'll give you a little extra time. So instead of a hundredth of a second for the atmosphere, you might get 3 seconds of the sunlight in the atmosphere. A little bit easier to collect some data that way. And same thing on the way out, too. So. Yeah, flying along it, spending more time in the shadow will give you more data. So we'll see what the results of that are. And then, of course, we're going to see what happens when New Horizons gets there.
Yep.
And when's that going to be?
I honestly don't remember. I've remembered the whole Bastille Day thing 2015 for so long. I don't remember when it's going to hit its next destination.
I got it. January the 1st, 2019.
Oh, another significant date then. That's nice. That'll be easy to remember.
Yep. Happy New Year's.
Indeed.
But people have to work New Year's Eve. Yes. Oh, well. It'd be worth it. And that is, of course, on the... you can go to the NASA webpage for that and look up the mission called SOFIA, which stands for... What does that stand for? SOFIA... Yeah. I just met an airplane named Sophia. Space Side Story.
That's what dear.
That musical is from. I can't. No, I don't.
Stratospheric Observatory for. Trying to remember what the other bits are.
Okay.
Yeah, the S is for stratospheric.
Okay. High flying.
Yep. High flying telescope. It's good to have a high flying telescope when you need to be over the ocean.
Exactly. Quick thing from quick alert notice from the AAVSO, American Association of Variable Star Observers, an observing campaign. This is people with a little bit more advanced telescopes with photography capabilities. They've got 20 cataclysmic variable stars that they want to observe with the William Herschel telescope here on the Earth. And the guy's doing a research project. These things can basically kind of explode at any time. So they want amateur astronomers to monitor 20 of these objects, and hopefully that they will be ready if one actually starts to explode. They'll catch it what's called outbursts. Usually it's kind of quiet and dim, and then they'll kind of get, maybe not explode, but they just get brighter by a couple of magnitudes rather quickly. And they want to catch one doing that so they can do some, again, spectral work. They can analyze the light and find out what's happening in that star when it does that. But these are all pretty faint. They're anywhere from around 19th magnitude to 15th magnitude. So that's obviously that would be somebody set up for photography that can image that faint. Now, I never did try actual limiting magnitude when I was at the museum with our system. Even a DSLR, I didn't try that. I was going to take a picture of a star region and maybe kind of a variable star region and go back to the AAVSO star charts. They always list the brightnesses of stars on there, especially the faint ones. And you can kind of get an idea of how, you know, faint of a star you can actually see through the system. But I never actually did that. Kind of hard to do that at our club's observatory because of all the light pollution, though.
Now, which campaign was it?
Alert notice 586.
586, 20 cataclysmic variables.
I'll
got
pop it. Indoor.
Nope, I got it.
Got it? Okay.
Yep, coming right up.
You can pop it, and I'll off it.
So we've got a couple other little stories in passing that are fun stuff. A very small star has been discovered. How small?
How small? How
Saturn
small is it?
Sized. Saturn size. Of course, with Saturn being famously so not dense that it would float in a large enough bathtub, a star of Saturn's size is a heck of a lot more dense than Saturn. And the gravitational pull at its surface would be about 300 times what humans would feel here on Earth. So, a lot more dense than Saturn, of course, or it wouldn't have stellar fusion going on. In fact, we think that it is probably as small as stars can possibly be, right at the limit where it has enough mass to enable hydrogen to fuse into helium and ignite that core.
It would be considered a full-blown star.
Yep.
Though dim and red, as opposed to non-nuclear fusion, but still radiating heat because of the leftover effects of gravity squeezing down the materials in the center of it, with some possibility of radioactive material in it. And those are called brown dwarfs.
And it turns out there's even more of them out there than we thought.
There is. Maybe not more than I thought. But.
Okay. They are as plentiful as stars, which that was a very strong possibility. But now we're pretty sure that for every successful star out there that has the mass to ignite, start stellar fusion, light up the sky, wherever it may be, there's at least one failed star out there. So it's a coin toss.
Mm-hmm.
So the Milky Way alone may be home to 100 billion brown dwarfs.
These are just under the size of being able to do nuclear fusion. Still fairly warm again because of their, you know, initial formation and gravity and possibly some radioactive material in there. But there is no nuclear fusion happening inside of these. And they're too big to be considered planets.
Yes, they are not hot Jupiters just randomly floating around.
Yep. So lots of them up there. I always said that the smaller the something is, the easier it is to make.
So, yeah, that's true.
A general rule in nature, basically, like look at trees. You got basically one trunk, so many dozen branches, you know, major branches, and smaller and smaller and smaller until you finally get the smallest, the farthest little tips. The smallest branches on a tree are the ones that are the most there. So kind of the way nature works that way. So bigger stars are the fewest. And then the smaller the stars, the more you have. So there would also be that the smaller the planet object, the more of them there are. So like Jupiters, yeah, there's less of those than there are rocky planets. And of course, they're more like asteroids.
They're just scattered around.
Yep. So smaller stuff is, basically the easier it is. And of course, space dust, gas, most of that's out there. Oh, what's he got? A Cassini spacecraft zooms in on one of the moons of Saturn called Epimetheus. I think I've got that pronunciation correct. And
another of the Titans.
We have one of the small moons of Saturn. We pop that into our chat room here. There we go. Did it go? There it is. Okay. Really lumpy. No, I mean cratered. Not really lumpy. It's kind of interesting. It's got a lot of streaks on it. I don't know if they determined why some moons have lots of streaks on them. Like something that might have reformed. But then it's also got a lot of craters too. But a lot of shallow craters. And they're not overlapping all that much on this moon. There's some crater chains and stuff like that, but just kind of every time we look at a new moon or a planet or something like that, it always looks a little bit different. You can't look at one and say, oh, that's just like this one and this one and this one. No, there's quite a difference and quite recognizable. I can't remember how this one's actually fairly small, about 70 miles in diameter. Let's see, what does it say? Too small for its gravity to hold onto an atmosphere, of course. But I don't know how hard it would be. How much gravity would it actually have? What percentage of the Earth's gravity would be? Kind of interesting. What was that 67P comet? Had Churyumov-Gerasimenko.
Yes, the Rosetta comet.
Yep, was only about 2 miles in diameter and had very, very little gravity. In fact, they had a hard time with the lander because it bounced about a mile high after it landed on it. There was so little gravity. So 70 miles will have a bit of gravity, but you know, think about the moon at 1/6 gravity. That's about 2,300 miles across. This one's only 70, so it's going to be quite a bit less. I don't think they'll mention what the scale of gravity is. So you might weigh 2 pounds. That'd be pretty easy to jump off. Well, think if you could throw a 2-pound baseball pretty high. So that means if you weigh 2 pounds, you can jump up pretty high. 70 miles, you probably wouldn't go into orbit if you were on it, though, jumping up. But you'd be able pretty high and then come back down. But you'd land at pretty much the same rate as you jumped up at, though. It's not so bad. Saturn's got a lot of cool small moons.
It does. No, it's got a really fascinating jumble of moons. I mean, it's got, of course, the great moon Titan, and then it's got a lot of slightly smaller moons that are fascinating, and even the little bitty ones like, Iapetus and are interesting. Whereas with Jupiter, it's basically, we care about the four big ones, and your average astronomer is not so keen on the rest.
Yep. It's like, another blob of a moon.
Yeah, another space potato flying around.
Yep, they're all just kind of not quite round.
And then we've got, Uranus, which of course has five lovely large-ish moons. The ones named for the original five named for the Shakespearean and Pope characters. But they're not any fun for most of us because they're far away and we won't see them.
Mm-hmm.
That's what Voyager picks are for.
Yep.
Uranus is really overdue for a space probe.
I think so.
Really overdue for high-res photography of Miranda and Umbriel and the rest.
Mm-hmm. I don't think anything's planned yet.
I haven't heard of anything.
I don't think so.
It's not a sexy target, I guess.
Yes, it doesn't have geysers on it like the moons of Saturn and Jupiter.
Well, right. Well, if your goal is to be investigating other worlds, and yes, moons are worlds, that might harbor life, you're going to be looking at Europa, and you're going to be looking at Enceladus and Titan, and you're not going to be herring all the way off to Miranda, Oberon, Titania, etc., looking at little rocky planets.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, not high on the list of priorities.
Mm-hmm.
So we got 2.5 minutes left, Marty. Have you got anything for us in closing?
I don't have any particular fun ones that I usually have, like
nothing
pyramids or anything
fun,
like that.
Nothing wacky. What a shame.
All right. But I'll do this one right here, though. This is an image from composite image, including Chandra, about something called a giant molecular cloud. Basically, it's a region in the Milky Way galaxy of a lot of gas and dust that is generally star-forming. So by using different types of telescopes, they can actually peer through the gas and see the stars actually forming in there, even though in white light the gas would be too hard to... did I get it in there now? There it is. Okay. Usually a lot of these star-forming... Oh, sorry, I did it twice. A little delay there. I have a W designation. This one's called W51. It's about 17,000 light-years away from us. And there's actually quite a few of those. You might not pay attention to these sometimes, but there's actually lots of giant clouds of gas that are beyond what we can see with our eyes. Not like the Orion Nebula, stuff like that, but pretty far out. But they peer through them with all X-rays. So new stars will actually show up in X-rays. There's one that looks like a really giant star, but they think, well, maybe that's actually two stars that formed close together. This picture got different colors in it. The blue is X-rays. One of them's infrared, and the yellow green. I can't remember what light they used for that one. So basically, infrared, X-rays, and maybe some white light, stuff like that. Read the article, check it out. And there's lots of clouds like that. It's interesting to think that they're just out there and out there and out there, usually along the band of the Milky Way when you're out observing them. Well, I think it's time for us to head on out of here. So I thank everybody in our chat room for being here. Really appreciate you coming in. Don't forget, we've got more programming like Astronomy Ireland coming up after Space Pirate Radio.
And a new Meteor Watch coming up right after us. It's only a minute, and then it's followed by our regular programming.
Cool. Good night, all.
Good night.